Okay, so good morning, everybody. It is a pleasure to see everyone. We are learning today on the topic of Seder in the Seder. So once a year, we get a chance to learn certain ideas that pertain to our Sederim, and we're called self-contained ideas, ideas which can come with us, accompany us, and hopefully not just things that we can repeat, but things that we can live. And I've looked at the last 10 years of these Shirim, and I've looked and I noticed that there's so many beautiful ideas to talk about, to think about, to appreciate. But I think that we're moving from ideas to ways of life, perhaps. And more than just fancy footwork, this year we're going to look at ideas which are actually challenges about living as well. The way that God is trying to ask us or demand of us certain ways of life. And so I'd like to start off on that note by thanking Karen and Michael Rosenblum for the sponsors of today's shiur. As we note the yahrzeit of Mr. Julius Sand Yehuda Ben Meir, Olav HaShalom Baruch Hashem, has namesakes both in flesh and also in continued mekomos hakadoshim, and which certainly follow the lifestyle that he led, a person whose honesty, integrity, and also his setting up a bias by Yisrael, a place where people would know many gedolei Yisrael will come to his place and rest under his shade. It should be a continued adias neshama for him. We're going to learn six ideas, folks. Six ideas today, and that's it. And try to keep himself contained. And here we go. The first is an idea which a friend of mine actually pointed out to me, which is found in the Haggadah called the Beis Aaron. The Beis Aaron goes to Rav Aaron ben Asher of Karlin. This was he was called Rav Aaron of Karlin the Second. So he was the Karlin, the Rebbe of Karlin in the 1800s. His father. So his grandfather was the first Rav Aaron of Karlin, and he says an observation, which I think if we allow ourselves to absorb, can be a transformative idea in the Seder. It's definitely a Hasidic idea, but it's...
Karlin?
Karlin was, I'm afraid I'm not 100% sure, I believe it's somewhere in Poland, but I don't know the exact... There we go. There we go. You know, the problem with these places is that every 2 minutes... it just depends where it is. And today there's one in Yerushalayim and there's one in Tveria. So it continues. Baruch Hashem. And there we go. And in Brooklyn. So Karlin Stolen has continued, but there's a lot of beautiful things. And so I know a few of the individuals from Karlin Stolen today who come and visit from Yerushalayim, very wonderful people. Baal Negina as well. So nonetheless, he says a very beautiful idea. He says that if you read sometimes the instructions of the Haggadah, you get a lot out of it, realizing that it's not just an instruction. So he says the following. This is in source one on the right hand side. We're just looking at the right hand side of today. Avi Zecher Tzadik Liracha Omar Kan Haben Shoel. You know, when you read the Haggadah, you open up Magid, and then there's instructions. You know, it's like that's in a different font. That's in the italics, and it says Kan Haben Shoel. Here the son asks. Okay, good. And you know, the little Yankala gets up on the chair and he says it in Yiddish because he just learned it at school this way, and it's wonderful. Okay, good. So he says, Pirush Shoel Hu Loshon She'ela Ubakasha. This is a request and beseeching, supplication. Rotzel Omar, this means Kan Yochol Habar Yisrael. That means any child of Israel is able Lishol Levakesh Me'aviv Shebashamayim Komash Tzarich Lekabel. Any and all of us are the children. We're not the children necessarily at the Seder. We're the children of the Ribbon Shalom of the Almighty. And we're able to ask as well. Lekabel chiyus al kol ha'dvarim balayla hazeh, to receive life force in this night. Ulasig mashele amal v'yagah al zos. And perhaps to get things that we didn't necessarily deserve or are deserving of. And if you think about that from this perspective, I actually have a very close friend who is a Rav in a shul, and one year he would ask around and make sure that everybody has siddur. I mean, there was a young couple in his shul, and it turns out they weren't going away, and they a lot of people in their youngest ages now are going to parents, going to programs, wherever it is. They're not yet staying. You don't have people in their 20s having their own siddurim. It was a little unusual at that point in time. So it turns out that they were in the process of in vitro fertilization, IVF, and they had tried 30 different eggs and nothing had been viable. They'd gone through a really difficult time. And the next stage of this of the process was going to be on Pesach, so they couldn't go away, so they were stuck. And only he knew this because he had been working and helping and struggling with them through this process. And so he invited them. He said, come for the Seder. And at his Seder, he always recounts this Rav Aaron of Karlin, this Beis Aaron. And as I got to Manishtana, he says, based on this Rav Aaron of Karlin, that we're going to take a moment, we're going to take 30 seconds, and we're going to ask everybody to make a request of the Leila Seder of Avinu Shavah Shemayim. Ends of 30 seconds. He says, now we're going to take another 30 seconds, and we're going to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to answer the requests of everybody else in the room now. Isn't it a beautiful thing? He says, 9 months later, she had a baby. Nine months to the day, that a baby. So there's a lot that's worth thinking about. This is a very, and this is, by the way, somebody I know. I'm not going to say names because it happens to be that it's discretion information. But this is something which perhaps is an overlooked point. Is the opportunity of the Leila Seder as being a time also for Tefillah as well, beyond that. Okay, point number one. Just that comes from an instruction in the Haggadah, not the actual Haggadah itself. Let's take a look at this halacha. I bet that most people have never ever thought about this before, and I didn't as well until I saw this Chaye Adam. The Chaye Adam is the Rav Danzig, who was wrote really one of the first sort of outside of Shulchan Aruch manuals of halacha, and the Chaye Adam was a very, very popular sefer. It's not based on the Seder of Shulchan Aruch. He sort of categorizes it into basic categories of halacha. He wrote the Chochmas Adam on Yoredea, and he wrote the Chaye Adam on the Orachaim on ritual parts of life. And many people used to learn this before the Mishnah Berurah and the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch came along. This is what was learned. So the Chaye Adam, he's quoted in the Mishnah Berurah, but the Rav Danzig says the following when it comes to the night of Pesach. And everybody's going to go home and look at their matzah decals, and they're going to notice what he says. It says in source two, he says, he says like this, Gimel matzos, at the top by the little parentheses in source 2, V'yachaste oisam ba-michseh, you should cover the matzos with a certain cover or cloth, k'moy b'shabbos, like you do on Shabbos, you cover your chalas, v'yom tov, ach, ma she no'agim, lichroich ha-matzos u'manichim ha-mitpacha, bein matzah le-matzah, hu minag burois. He says that which people have the custom to wrap every matzah individually and to have a space, a material between each of the matzahs. He says that is a custom of buros. What's a bur? A bur, right? It's a fool. It's a foolish minhag, he says, to have such a thing. Baalehem. And then he goes on and he discusses the Seder plate. So Rav Danzig is quoting a minhag which he believes is not a substantiated minhag, and that is the minhag to separate the matzos between each of them. Now, folks, if you go home and look at your matzah cover, did you notice something interesting? Every matzah cover has the tears, right?
I have one without.
Right, there we go. It's the Chaye
Adam. Made by someone. No, we didn't know better.
There we go. Okay. It could have been that they followed the Chaye Adam. But did you notice that? Did you notice that your chalak, and even the trays, right? There's three trays. And he dismisses this, but it seems to be that that's Minag Yisrael. Where did that come from? Why is it not like Shabbos and Yom Tov? He's got a good point. Where did this come from? So if you look at, actually, the Lechem Aponim, the Lechem Aponim is a Pirush on, if we're talking about the Lechem Aponim, where would it be a Pirush on? Just think about this for a moment. Must come after the Chaye Adam, because he's quoting the Chaye Adam. But if it's talking about the Lechem Aponim, what pirush would the bread of the table be on? It would be on the table, right? What's the table? The Shulchan Aruch, the set table, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. So the Lechem Aponim is the pirush of Rav Shlomo Gansried on himself. And in his footnote, he says, and he quotes this Chaye Adam in source 3, and he says, Kosem Sefer Chaye Adam is Elishonoi, Ach Ma Shinoagim Likroch HaMatzos HaManich Mitpachas Ben Mitzmatz LaMatzos Minag Burois, Ad Kanashonoi, so he quotes the Chaye Adam we just saw. He says, Aval Chacham Echad Hirani, he said, a certain sage showed me, Besefer Kol Yaakov, Shekosov, Kain, Sheben Matzah, Matzah, Yi, I have said, Bamavu, Loi, Kumai, Beshabbos, Lekosov, Sham, Tama, De Milsa. He says, I actually found in a Sefer called Kol Yaakov that, in fact, there is such a minag. So perhaps we should be more careful, he's saying to the Chaye Adam, than dismissing the minag. There is source for such a thing. So I said, oh, what's the Kol Yaakov? So I did a little bit of investigation. And if you dig deep enough, you find the Kol Yaakov, in fact, is written by a person by the name of Rav Yaakov Koppel, as you can see on the right here on the bottom, page 2. And it is actually talking about many of the minhagim of the Arizal. And so I found the Sefer, and here he talks about it. So the Sefer is, so again, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is defending this minhag from the attack of the Chayei Adam. Just a few years later, a later colleague to the Chayei Adam, the end of the 1800s. And he says that if you look carefully, there's this minhag has a raglaim. So in source 5 is where this appears. And he says, we're not going to look at the whole paragraph because that's about other aspects of preparation of the table. By the way, most people don't do this. Look at the beginning of Haggadah. Every good self-respecting Haggadah has a section at the beginning about setting up the table. Most people skip that over. It's worthwhile. Every Haggadah has to talk about how you set it up and literally minhagim. There's a lot of very beautiful things to be found in the introductions, which most people never get to. This is the introduction. The Kol Yaakov was telling us how we set up the Seder plate. That was what the Chayei Adam was doing as well. And he says, let's just look where this part starts. So here he goes. He says, I think we're going to start with the last word on the line is b'mapa. Okay, just about halfway down. It's in Rashi scripts. It's a little harder. He says v'simon echad lamala bein kol matzah yeh hefsek mapa. There should be a cloth between each matzah. Loikamo Shabbos, not like on a regular Shabbos where they're together, the chalas are touching. Ki b'Shabbos kol ayud beis kikoros mitzvah achas. V'ru muzim l'kavona achas. On Shabbos, all the breads, whether it's 2 or 12, because there's some people have the minhag going 12 chalas because of the lechem upon him. If you've ever seen this. So they're all together because it's really essentially one mitzvah. Ma she'en ken ato, ha'gimu matzo is kol echad mitzvah bifnei atzmo. Each one is its own mitzvah, kol echad roimez l'kavona miyuchedes. Each one has its own intention. Lachain sorich hefsek bein kol echad ve'echad. He says that's why you should have the gap between each of them, because they actually represent different things as opposed to Shabbos, where the two chalas represent the same thing. So you say, okay, well, what are those kavanas? He doesn't explain what they are. He assumes that, of course, we are fluent in what they all mean, and therefore all he needs to say to us is they represent different things, and therefore we should obviously know the outcome. So just to dig a little further into the Haggadah of the Kerem HaTzvi, this is Rav Tzvi Hirschfeber, living at the end of the 1800s to the 1900s, and he writes the following on this observation, and this is in the middle of the paragraph, on the top of page 3, there's the little emboldened Ummah. Each one is its own mitzvah. The first one you say, the blessing of alachilas matzah, on eating matzah. It's the second one, which is the broken one, you say amoitzi, right? So you lift them up, and some people at the minhag have all three, then they drop the bottom one, right? And the second one is moitzi. He points out in brackets, lach ma'anya. And that's called the lechem oini, the poor man's bread, because it's already broken. And the bottom one is korech. So we have actually three separate stages in the Seder. One is moitzi, matzah, korech. And that relates to each of the three matzahs. And therefore, because each one actually relates to a different requirement of the Seder, we wrap them individually as opposed to on the Friday nights as well. Now, and I was just thinking about this, and if that's the case about pieces of unleavened bread, then surely it should be the case about people too. Meaning to say, tonight is a night where we give everything its own space. Tonight is a night where we think about everything in its own domain. We're not rushing. If this matzah is about moitzi, it has its own space. If this is about lechem oni, it has its own space. If this is about korech, it has its own space. I think that perhaps if we look around the table, we can realize that everybody around the table also comes from their own space. They've each had their own life experiences. Each person in the Adar Seder has some sort of background, some sort of context, some sort of experience this last year which has shaped them in a different way. And perhaps it's worthwhile looking at each one individually in their own silo, not just putting everybody together, not just putting different things together. So now we stop and appreciate the process. We appreciate everybody from where they come. This is an interesting observation, and everybody goes back home and takes a look at their matzah kavel will now appreciate where this comes from, where this minhag arrives from, and perhaps some of the deeper perspective on this the next time we're more careful as we do that moitzi matzah as well. Idea number 2. This is an interesting halachic idea which emerged. Idea number 3. So I always wondered about this. Let me ask you a question. Is there such a thing as a mitzvah which is only for the masses? Like a mitzvah which is differentiated based on intellectual capacity. You know what they say? That they say that lottery is called the idiot tax, right? That's what some sarcastic people say, right? Because who buys it? The odds of buying the lottery are so infinitesimally minimal that getting a lottery ticket it's basically a tax, a government tax on those who really think they're going to. So I mean that's obviously a very arrogant way of looking at things. But can you think of a mitzvah which is only for those who are not intellectual? No, so that if you think about it, there's no such mitzvah. It's not like you're saying, oh, well, there's payah for the clever farmers. And then there's, you know, the lesser ones, they have a little more, right, because they didn't read the fine print. Torah doesn't work like that. Torah doesn't address different tiers of intellect. You notice that? There's no system like many later philosophers talk about, different populaces and how they should be dealt with differently, and you get to social Darwinism, which leads to Nazi Germany, and you get all kinds of, and eugenics, there's all kinds of things. If you listen to James Watson over here out on Long Island, and he believed in that, he still believes in that, that we should get rid of the bottom 10% of the people who are intellectually fledgling, who don't, they're just a burden on society. So let's get rid of that group of people. So Judaism doesn't do that, right? So isn't it funny that in Avodim Ayino we talk about the following? The Leil HaSeder says to us that afilu kolon lachachamim kolon nevoinim kolon yodas haTorah mitzvah l'nesaper v'sias mitzvah kol ha'ugara ha'mar b'lesaper arayzim meshuvach. You might have thought that the smart people were parted from this, right? Maybe the smart people, they had a free pass. They did this last year. they got a passing grade. That gives them 5 years on the we'll call the jury duty of the Seder. They're good. What do you think? Suddenly you get a pass because you're smart? That's not how Judaism works. What is the Haggadah addressing? The Haggadah is trying to address a thought we may have had that the intellectual people were out. Have you ever seen anything else in Judaism that operates like that? That we would have thought that way? That we need to have a waiver? So perhaps the observation is not about smart people. Maybe that guy is actually not addressing that. It's addressing a much more fundamental idea. And that is that if you look at the actual way that the psukim describe this whole mitzvah, this is to be found in the Imre Baruch, of Baruch Simon Sefer on Pesach. He quotes, this is his own words over here. He says on the top of page 4, a very beautiful observation. He says, just to the pasuk. The pasuk is 3 lines on the bottom of on the right hand column. He says, "Lemanta saper bozne bincha ben bincha, v'yedei zeh v'yedatem kine ani Hashem." The pasuk says you should tell your children, and you should know that I am God. That's what he says. You know what the pasuk does not say? He says, "V'loiksiv v'avinoisim ovetaskilu kine Hashem." You should understand. You should conceptualize that I'm God. That's not what the pasuk says. It says v'idatem. You should know. He points out that the Torah is not meant to be an intellectual process. The Torah is not meant to be about me figuring out, gazing at the stars and figuring out through the incredible mass and the fact that the universe is expanding at exponential rates and the galaxies are moving away from us and we say, wow, God, I got it. That's not what the Torah asks from us. It asks from us a yediyah. And guess what? The idea does not come from intellect. Knowledge doesn't come. This real knowledge, what the Torah is demanding from us, doesn't come from all kinds of fancy pirouettes in our mind. And what the Haggadah is saying, says Rabbi Simon, take a look at this. At the top of the next page, on the top of the next column on the left. V'im kain, mikra mole diber akosov al yedei sipur yetzias mitzrayim v'yedatim kine Hashem u'mimela. You know how you get to emuna? Not through intellect, but through emuna. And sometimes, interestingly enough, it's stories which affect that more than ideas. Isn't that interesting? I had this moment, I mentioned this a few days ago, but that sometimes, the joke goes, that how often can you repeat a story? So I say a story, maybe once every year, maybe. A joke, you could maybe once every 2 years. And Dvar Torah, and they say between, you know, Shachris and Shlishis, you know, that's how the cynical joke goes. But the truth is, I used to feel somewhat negative about this because people would be like, wow, that was such a great drasha. You're like, what a great joke or story, and like nothing else. There was like, and the idea was like, it flashed, you know, the story. That stay, and I used to think, you know, rabbis are just glorified storytellers. You know, like you just get a good story. Ideas, forget about the ideas. But the truth is that we had the opportunity of sitting with Rav Aaron Lapiansky just a few months ago here in Woodmere, and he said an interesting thing, and I asked him this question. He says, maybe the story is the most effective way of communicating an idea in a real sense. And that's why the Leil HaSeder is a story. That's why most of Emunah in the Torah is learnt from stories, not ideas. The whole of Bereishis, I mean, like really technically speaking, it's not mitzvah, so why should it be there? That's the first Rashi in the Torah. The answer is because stories convey values much more than intellectual ideas. And what the Leil HaSeder is teaching us is that it doesn't matter how much we know. It doesn't matter to say if we know Meseches Pesachim off by heart, if we know all the depth of the halachas of Korban Pesach. You know what? That's wonderful. It's not about intellect, it's about experience. And experience is only gained through stories, is only gained through shared experience. And therefore, this is a much more sophisticated way of arriving at the ultimate of what this Leil HaSeder is. It's funny, like I remember just in an immature sense when I came back from Israel and trying to tell these Divrei Torah, all that Divrei Torah with these intellectual ideas and brisker rovs and beis halevis, and it's wonderful. But in the end of the day, and we should know all these things, but it's not about intellect. Does it affect us? Do we live differently? Do we breathe differently? Is Hashem part of our lives? That's the question of the Leil HaSeder. And that's why it's dismissing not the wise, but the wise part of us that thinks we've accomplished our goal by knowing, by just the intellectual understanding. That's what's happening. Yes, sorry.
You were talking about grades of intellect, but don't we learn from the man that it was the different levels of emuna that in which people were given their man? Some were given them already prepared. Some had to put some good more effort in. Some had to put a greater effort based on their emuna.
Precisely. So it's not about knowledge. It's about emuna. That's exactly the point. Meaning, what the Agada is dismissing is intellect. Is intellect being the deciding factor? What's the deciding factor? Is emuna. How do you get to emuna? Is the more we talk, the more we imbibe in ourselves. Then there's differences. Yes, you'll see that the man arrives closer or more distantly. But that was about actually a feeling of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is much more powerful. Much more powerful. You're right, that is an interesting differentiation, but not in thought. Yes?
If that was the case, we should be answering the Chacham.
Oh, yes.
We should be answering, because the Chacham's lack. This adds to the whole approach of the Chacham. The Chacham and the Rasha. The Chacham's got the same problem as the Rasha, and we're answering him the wrong way. We're just answering with giving him more facts. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be answering him.
Very good. Very good. Very good. It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. And so, meaning to say, a lot of times we put, and perhaps this leads to the next idea, and that is that we put at the top of the totem pole the Chacham, the wise person, we say, and Maftirach al Pesach have become, and the Mepharshim explain that's our last mission in Maseches Pesachim, so we taught in the whole of Pesachim, and that's how we. And the truth is that different people learn differently, and some people really need Chachma, and you're giving them Chachma, you're feeding, but you're saying maybe you're feeding the wrong habit. So the truth is you need both, meaning you can't just sit there on a stone saying, I'm going to believe in God, and you don't even know any, you know, you don't know what Modiani is. Right? So you need to know what Shachris is. You need to know, there needs to be the basis, there needs to be intellect. You can't, you know, most people. I have no ideas. I meet so many times people who say, like, you know, I spend a little time in Israel and I so want to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and I want to talk about that all day long. It's like, but what do you do with that? Like, you know, so you need to have something to do with that. But the truth is when you look at the different sons, there's a very beautiful observation made by the Akedas Yitzhak. The Akedas Yitzhak was Rav Yitzhak Arama, who lived in Spain at the time, just the late 1400s. And he, in his commentary, most people don't learn the Akedas Yitzhak because it's extensively long. It's extensively long. It's wonderful. He has incredible essays on the Torah and beyond. And so he has the following observation. He says, let's look at the four sons. And he says, if you look at the Tam, usually we look at the Tam in a derogatory sense. We say, he is the stupid, intellectually missing, lacking son. So he, in fact, the way that the Yerushalmi translates the Tam is, Ben? Is anybody familiar? Ben Atipesh. So the Yerushalmi interprets, the Yerushalmi Talmud interprets him as being intellectually deficient, seen as a fool. And that's usually the picture we get. And at best, the pictures are sort of somebody looking stupefied and they're like, you know, deer in the headlights kind of picture in our Agadas. Doesn't really look like the person is really, you know, wizard 100%. So Rav Yitzchak Aramaz says that maybe actually Tam comes from the idea of simplicity. Like it calls Yaakovinu Ish Tam Yoshev O'alem. He was a simple person. That does not mean to say that Yaakovinu was stupid, right? Yaakovinu was a pure, simple person. In fact, when it comes down to the laws of Nezikim, there's what's called a Shor Muad and a Shor Tam. A Shor Tam does not mean a stupid ox. It means to say a ox which is not goring others, which is self-contained, is living in a space where it was unexpected, it was unanticipated that it gored, in fact. And so he quotes the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. Well, the Orach Chaim HaKadosh says, also commenting on this period of time in the 1400s in Spain, he said that it was interesting to note that when there was a choice put in front of Jews, the unimaginable choice of kissing the cross or leaving with the very high likelihood that somebody in the family is going to die in travel and they're going to lose all their wealth, he says it wasn't the intellectual Jews who managed to survive that test. He says all the great intellectuals actually capitulated. It was the simple men, women, and children who didn't know so much Judaism who made the right choice and left. Do you know that the most famous Jew in all of Spain, do you know what his name was at the time of the expulsion of Jews? Do you know what his name was? He was Don... No. Ababina was the second most famous Jew in Spain. The second most famous and most powerful Jew in Spain. The most powerful and well-known Jew in Spain was Abraham Senor. Don Abraham Senor. And guess what? He had a lot of money and a lot of assets. And he wasn't prepared to give those up so fast, and he converted to Christianity. Okay, so he did not leave it behind. Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, who was the second most powerful Jew in Spain at the time, did. He left everything behind after lobbying the government, Ferdinand and Isabella, and not successfully, he moved to Vienna. And he wrote on the fly his Pirushanach, you know, like I didn't even show him as he was doing that. Amazing, right? But what Orach Chaim was saying was that it wasn't the sophisticated who made the right choice. It was the simple who made the right choice. Yeah, and to what was that?
That's what he said. I lost everything that I started to learn about.
Yeah. Well, he was a remarkable human being in so many ways. But if you think so, just to take it one step further, Rabbi Norman Lamb in the Haggadah called the Royal Table says, is actually just such a beautiful quotation on this comment. He says, this is in Source 8, page 4. Science reigns supreme in our society. Knowledge is universally acknowledged as the key to a better job, a more convenient society, as power in the world of international relations. Yet when the mind and its achievements are so stressed that all else is excluded, that a person is considered a machine whose love and hate, loves and hates and fears and passions and aspirations are trivial, then we have outsmarted ourselves. Then humanity is in eclipse, and the individual becomes a freak child who an abnormally large head, an undersized body and heart. Let us not forget that was Solomon, the wisest of men, the Chacham Mikol Ish, who taught, Al tischakem yoter, do not be over wise. The term in this way of in his way of Tamimut is not one of wit less intellectually competent than the sophisticated Chacham. Let us emphasize this again and again. The term, as a full Jew, is fully cognizant of the value and wisdom and possesses learning in abundance, but he insists upon integrating learning into totality of a responsive, religious, reverent personality. The Talmud declares, be not overwise. Religion, especially Judaism, cannot be grasped only by reading and debating. Although that is unnecessary for any intelligent person, it must, in the final analysis, be tasted and tried. Instead of being a chacham and seeking proof of God's existence, we should be a tam and offer proof in ourselves and our daily conduct of the existence of a mensch, a human being, a Jew with a heart and a soul. Isn't that a beautiful observation? So sometimes perhaps in defense of the tam, in defense of what it means to be a tam, and it comes back to the previous idea again. Chachamim and Nevoim, those are wonderful. and we produce them in abundance, but it can't be that the only worthwhile members of Jewish society are the Chachamim and Nevoinim. That's not how it works. The Amcha is where it's at, and that's the majority of Klal Yisrael folks, the people who are forced with complicated decisions and try to make a difference in those moments, in those spaces as well. I want to just add in one little quick little twist over here, and I think it's just worthwhile appreciating this, and that is that the test that Eliezer sets up to find Rivka, very famous, he goes to the well, what does he say? He says, whoever's going to give me and my camels water is going to be it. And the Gemara says, you know, Eliezer, that's a little bit of a dangerous game, you know. You don't know who's going to come out. You don't know what's going to be. And the Gemara gives us an example is of one of the people's Shoel Shaloi Kohagen. He asked inappropriately. It was a little bit of a dangerous test to put out. So the question is, like, what was he doing exactly? Like, what was this game? He's trying to find, you know, this is high stakes, right? This is one of the matriarchs, one of the big three or four going to be in Maras HaMachpelah. It's like not as, this is not like something small, right? At least like an SAT score or something, right? But so what was he doing precisely? So there's a very famous essay written by Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria. Does anybody know what he founded? The whole B'nai Akiva networks. He was a Talmud of Rav Kook. He lived in Kfar HaRoeh, brilliant, brilliant individual, very special person. He wrote many things, and on his Pirush on the Torah, he makes the following observation. You know, it talks about Avram and Sarah, they go through a Nefesh HaShir Asu B'Charan, they made all these souls in Charan, and they brought all these people closer to Torah and Mitzvahs. Well, he says, well, where were they exactly? Like, you know, you don't meet them so much afterwards, and they all left behind. What happened to them? So you can say, well, it was the project, you know, the outreach project lasted then, but then they disappeared. Like, what happened with that? That seems like a very very sad outcome of the project, right? So he says that maybe they really did believe in monotheism. Abram and Sarah, they really convinced them. But, you know, to sell your tennis court, their kids were in school. They're still paying the mortgage for another 25. They just refinanced. To go now make this trip into the middle of nowhere into this is not, they're leaving a Semite territory to go to Amorite territory for no reason. That was too much. They believed in God, but they stayed kind of, they trailed off as it went, but they still believed in God. He says, well, if you think about it, how does it work? It says, Avram Magayer Anashim, Vesara Magayeres Nashim, right? So Avram was converting the men, and Sarah was having an effect on the women into this monotheistic principle that they were preaching. How did Avram Avinu discover God? That we have multiple midrashim which describe the different ways that Avram Avinu discovers God. The most famous one is books written on this, the little kid children's books. Is, you know, Avram Avinu is looking at the sun, and then he sees the moon, and then the wind, and then the clouds, and the wind, and the mountains, right, the whole thing. And he realizes, intellectually, he realizes there must be a power over all these powers. And he arrives at HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's what he's teaching people. But how did Sarah teach it? How did Sarah teach it? It doesn't say anything about Sarah finding intellectual God. You know what it says? The Gemara says there's two ways of finding God. One is through intellect. The other one is through action, where a person lives a life of chesed, lives a life of representing what it is. In fact, how did Avraham do it? It says he planted an eishel. We had this inn. People will come in. They say, "Oh my goodness, this is the soup. This is unbelievable, right?" And Avraham says, "Oh, you want to thank the balabayas." Pivoted upwards and thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? So turn it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She was expressing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in action, in kindness, in thoughtfulness, in altruism. Well, if Avraham Avinu's mark was left intellectually and Sarah's mark was left experientially, when Eliezer came back to find a wife for Yitzchak, he was looking for the residual effect of the Nefesh Asher Asu B'Charan. And how do you find that? You don't find it through the SAT scores. You don't even find it through essays written on the belief of God. That's the Avram camp. That's the men's side of the side. He was looking for it in action. I need to find somebody who's been affected by Sarah in this place who would do what Sarah would do. And therefore he looks for somebody who's going to give chesed. In fact, when it says that how did Rivka, this young lady, know all this? It says she has a person who helped her. Her name was Devorah, Menekes Rivka. What is a Menekes? He says a nurse wife. Well, the truth is that she still remained a few parishes later, a number of decades later, when Rivka was clearly beyond the nursing stage. So the Torah Targum Mungkala says, it says that she was the Padgavasa. That's the translation. That word is actually also as pedagogue, which means she was her teacher. Argues Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria that Devorah was one of the nefesh, asher asubachar, and one of the residual remains, the vestigial remainders of the teachings of Sarah, who was able to transmit that to her, this fledgling Rivka, and therefore, although Sarah never really met Rivka, they did through ideas or through the expression of Devorah in the middle. And that was what it was meant to be. And that's not about intellect. It wasn't about intellect. It was about action. It was about experience. In a much more profound sense, that was what Eliezer was looking for. That's Tam. That's Tamimus as well. And finally, we'll take a look at two more ideas together, and we'll close it with this. I'm sorry for the delay, the tangent. But here we go. This is a very important halach. It's the first mission in the 10th parak of Psachim, which is called Arei Psachim, the most commonly learned parak in Psachim, because it deals with the Leil HaSeder. The first 9 parakim deal with Bior Chametz, Bedikas Chametz, and Korban Pesach. But the last parak deals with the Leil HaSeder, and the Mishnah says a very famous line, Afilu Oni Shebi Yisrael Lo Yochal Ad Sheyesev, a person Sheyosev. Even the poorest of poor cannot eat until they do his saber. Why would you think otherwise?
Nothing to lean on.
So, practically speaking, his saber is usually understood as an expression of regal bearing, and the person who can't, you know, rub two quarters together, you say, how could they lean? Like, what are they like? You know, how can they act like a prince or princess if they don't feel like they really have anything? That's what the Mishnah seems to be addressing. Even they get to lean on this light. Even they're considered free people. So the truth is that the Midrash makes a very strange observation. The Midrash says that maybe we misunderstood the word Heseba. Heseba we usually understand to mean to lean, right? To leaning on the left and everybody's flipping their chairs. But the Midrash comments and says on the Pasuk in the beginning of Bashalach, which is going to be relevant to the last days of Pesach, it says, Vayasev Elokim es ha'am, derech ha'abibar, yam suf. Hashem pivots the nation from the direction. If you want to enter into the land of Israel, the natural way from the Sinai Peninsula is to go through Gaza. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu turned them. He turned them away from Gaza back into the desert, and that's when they arrived at the banks of the Red Sea. Okay, that's what the Torah tells us. Says the Midrash, Vayasev Elokim Esa'am in source 11, Mikan Amru Rabboseinu Afilu Onu Shebi Yisrael Lo Yochal Ad Sheyesev. What is going on up here? The Midrash is saying how Hashem turned the nation. That's the same word. Vayasev Elokim Esa'am Ad Sheyesev. Like, really? Is that what? Like, that? It sounds like what Chazal did was they pressed Control F, right? And so anytime the word Yasev appears, like, here we go, okay, look at that, Parshas B'Shalach, wouldn't you know? Even has to do with the Pesach theme, you know, Begadol, like, loosely speaking. Like, what does that mean? Like, the two have nothing to do with each other. Turning the nation around has no connection to what's going on at the Seder. Like, are we supposed to turn in circles? Like, what is going on over here? Rav Soloveitchik in his Agada in the Masoras Harav, which came out just a few years ago, really worthwhile having, it says the following observation, which is so beautiful. He says, Dana Medrash, Eina rak mischak milim. He says, this is not a word game that we can find two words which are parallel. Listen to this, and this is so relevant to our lives. B'nei Yisrael nodadu b'midbar. The nation of Israel, they were nodadu. What's the word? What would you translate that as? And now they were wandering. They had no destination in the desert. Lifnei she'egiu le'eretz Yisrael, before they arrived in their destination of Israel. V'adayin samchu al tzeisomim Mitzrayim. They are still happy about the fact that they managed to leave such a decrepit place. They knew that they weren't going in through Gaza into Israel, which is where they should have been going. But they knew in the end they would come to the right place. But Domelekach, he says, let's transpose that to our lives. Ha'anijim in Yisrael, the person who is impoverished, and folks, it doesn't mean impoverished in money only, emotionally. There's people who suffer so many things, we carry so many burdens in our lives. There's so many sicknesses in our lives. There's so many difficulties in our lives. Ani Shav Yisrael, every person who is carrying something which is a burden to them, ha'oleich b'midbaroi ha'prati shaloi, who walks in their own personal desert, kol yom hu ma'avak avuroi v'udoeg mimash shetzofun lo'asid, and they don't know what the future is going to bring. They don't know if they're going to get out of this. They don't know if there'll be a resolution to their crisis. Af al pi kein, a lovely smoach al gu'ulosoi mimitzrayim, still has the responsibility of saying, I got out of something else. Lashir es ha'alel, to sing ha'alel, v'lishtos arai kosas shol yayinu l'sahasev, and to lean. Gamu tzorich la'avin, that person should know. She'af shenisibos hachayim mazifim elov panim. Even though what faces them is terrible and the storms are unintelligible, hu chelek miklal yisrael. They're part of a bigger picture. Shiroi ha. Yeah, eschatology. This is eschatological, so to speak. Eschatology. Vada yagia l'si'oi begula shlema. There will be an end. They may feel like we were turning away from our destination. We may feel like we're going back into the desert of difficulty. It's still vayaseh Elokim. Hashem is part of that process. So part of the leaning is specifically to the Anish of Yisrael, the person who has burdens. And in those burdens, realizing it's vayaseh Elokim, Hashem is with us in that. And there's still room to be mesamech, to enjoy the paths of success, even though the future remains uncertain. That's a beautiful observation, and that's what the Midrash is saying. Very, very powerful, powerful observation. And finally, we'll end with one beautiful observation. Last year, I got a Haggadah, which is called Likutim from the Chidah, Rav Yosef David Azulai. I mean, folks, you have no idea how much he wrote. He was unbelievable. On the Haggadah, they have no less than 7 separate Pirushim or Likutim of the Chidah on the Haggadah. It's astronomical how much the Chidah wrote. All on the Haggadah. And in fact, you can go through these and you can find completely different ideas in the same paragraph. It wasn't like he had his go-to ideas that he came back to. So one idea on Dayenu. Dayenu is such a profound moment in the Seder that we think about all the moments in life that if we weren't to have them, if we didn't have those forks in the road, those signs, we would never be where we are. The Chidah says, I'm going to start on the fourth line of the Chidah in Source 13. He says, "Vezer remez, ba'amro kama ma'alos tovos, ki teva kama." You know, we start the Dayenu, kama ma'alos tovos. Why that word kama? Osios makor. Same words as a makor, which is what we just talked about in the previous paragraph, which is plagues, difficulties. Shom remez ki midas adin asher hoso aleinu chala al hamitzrim. These are things which we really didn't deserve. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu pivoted them onto the Mitzrim. We should have really been there as well. We weren't much better than the Mitzrim, as the angels pointed out. But Hashem turned the Makkah into a Kama Ma'alos, to the many, many good things that we reserved. He says, however, this is not a free Devar Torah. This has a bite. V'inei, Dina B'Gematria, Makkah, the word Din, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's judgment, is also the notion of a Makkah. Shehuku Makkah Rabbah, that the Egyptians suffered, but we really should have been part of that. And ours was turned into mercy. Kamamalas to a voice. What does that mean? Yesh mishapiresh lemakom aleinu. What does it mean that all these ma'alos, these great ascendancies? Kolamar daonu chayovim al kol hatovois haelu koimer kama chayvois yesh aleinu. Let's put this, make this clear. Do we deserve any of these things? Not in the least bit. Were we worthy of this? Not at all. And so therefore, when you say Kama Malas Tovos, we should have been with the Mitzrim, we should have been in the Makos. HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided that we would, on credit, get the Malas Tovos, and therefore we have a lot to be thankful for. And then it's funny, then, if you ask those questions, well, if you brought us across the sea and didn't give us the money, if you brought it to us and not given the Torah, would that really been enough? The answer is, why are you so entitled? You don't deserve anything. That's the point. The point is that all of this was an investment in you, without any credits. That's what was happening. We have a responsibility to pay back. That's what's going on. In fact, this reminds me of the observation which was made by Rav Shimon Shkop. And I highly recommend it. Perhaps one day we should just do this together. Is just to learn Rav Shimon Shkop's introduction to Shari Yashar or Ishari Yosher, which is such a profound essay. It's a life-changing essay. He talks about the idea of being able to expand oneself, one's consciousness, to care about other people. And how when one's able to do what is really the Torah asks of us, which is, after l'reacha kamoicha, is not saying to eliminate the self, but to expand the self to include others. That's when we really become emissaries or agents of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because that's what Hashem is doing with us. Such a profound idea. And then he says the following observation at the tail end of his essay, where he says the following. V'chein efshar, he says, v'hargish b'inyan ha'mesupar b'gmor ha'tanis ma'aseh nora, describes a terrifying case in Tanis, Be'ish Kodesh Nachum Ish Gamzu. Very famous individual, Nachum Ish Gamzu. Everything that happened in his life, Gamzu L'tov. That's why it's called Gamzu. Shayadei Shepam Achas Leimilei Chayvosa B'mitzvah Tzedakah L'fi Har Goshasai. He didn't due stocker to the capacity he felt that he was he ought to have done. Gozar al atzmoi she yisam uhu einov v'yisgadmu yodov yiskat u raglov. He felt that he was not doing his job, and he decreed in his mind that because he didn't do this enough, he did not deserve his arms, his feet, and his eyes. V'chein niskaimu gzeros, and that's what happened. That was the end of Nachum Ish Gamzu. V'u kefi aderech hanahug etzel asarim agdolim, she'im margish ba'atzmoi shalei milei chovas od chovas mishmartoi, hu magish ba'kasho lepatro mim mishmartoi. Intellectually honest leaders who feel they're not doing what they should have, feel like they're wasting their time as who they should have been, they exuent. Not today. Today you can barely get them out. But you have to realize that it's important to leave. What was happening in his mind? He said like this, Hashem, you invested and you endowed in me all these kochos, all these strengths, and I'm just not doing it enough. I'm not doing enough. He says, I have to return the lease. It's not mine to give if I'm not doing what I'm supposed to. Lachain, im rak korola mishkeb mishmiras tafkir agizboris shaloi. When he felt as a steward upon his kochos, his strengths in life, and he felt that he wasn't fulfilling it, gozal kol evrov lipoelis b'lipoter me'avorasam, he said, I don't deserve to have them. Vechainu b'shefa al hashamayim al kinin ha'achochma. He says the same is true about every one of us, about our intellectual capacity as well. Shiro'oi l'kol ish, every person should think, Hashem all gave us special things, and they're all different. We all measure ourselves on the same grid, but every has got different abilities, different challenges. Everybody is a gizbar, is a steward on their life experience and their skills. That's not because Hashem said, "Oh, I like you, and I'm going to give you a special." No, that's your job. He's to find the people who need your endowment most. You're brilliant intellectually. Find people to teach. Share it. Help people. Be a tutor. Do something to help somebody. If you're doing your job right as a rep, you're going to get more because that was what you're supposed to do. When the Gemara tells us in Makos Daf Yud that a person learns most from their students. Okay, it's great to have students. Very important. But more than that, if I'm given a certain amount of wherewithal, where it's financial, emotional, intellectual, and I use it to help others, then by doing so, I'm validating the investment in me, which will therefore actually call for an opening of the sluice gate for more of an investment as well. And if you think about this for a moment, we were all born not deserving very much, right? We've not substantially, we had no track record. There was nothing to show. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu made an incredible investment. I remember reading, if anybody has had a chance to read, there's a book called Towers of Light, which was about the battle between AC and DC current in the advent of electricity in America. And it was the turn of the 20th century. This is when this really was at the cracks in the World's Fair in the 1890s, where whether it was going to be Edison or Westinghouse who were going to produce the light bulbs, was, of course, Edison. But Edison was misled. He went on DC current, and that was not ultimately going to be successful. Ultimately, Westinghouse won under the auspices of Nikola Tesla. And the moment where this all changed was the creation at Niagara Falls of the cataract, where they were able to harness the electricity of Niagara Falls and supply the first electricity to a city in Buffalo. Right? This was, and how did they get it that far? It was because they used alternating current. And at this magnificent moment, when they completed the year's work of the cataract, of this, the pivoting of the waters of Niagara and taking it and being able to turn it into electricity, the first time ever done in human history, Nikola Tesla gets up and he gives a speech about this incredible success, about the harnessing of the power of the raging waters into power, which would change America, would change the known world. And it was this beautiful evening. They had a dinner there overlooking where you can still go today and see the tours of that tunnel that they made. And he made this beautiful poetic, as he was, a very poetic soul, very ethereal soul about life. And afterwards, the investor gets up. And the investor, I don't remember if it was Vanderbilt or J.P. Morgan, who, not the bank, the man, who gets up. And these are all the funders, because this was a very expensive project. And after this beautiful night at an event of wine and romantic speeches, he gets up and he says, yeah, we invested a lot of money over here. We haven't seen it back yet. When are we getting tachlis the money? And like broke the whole evening when the investor says, you know, like, yeah, we all the greatest and all the steel industry, the coal, the railroad industry, all those investors invested in this. And that's why I came. And he says, but when are we seeing a return? And in a certain sense, I wonder if that sometimes happens about all of us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is an investor. And he puts a lot of money into us. He puts a lot of kochos into us. And there's no track record. There's no opportunity. When is he going to see a return? When does he see a return in us? It takes a little bit of time. You know, maybe the early years we're learning, the teen years we're trying to figure ourselves out. Then maybe in the 20s we start figuring things out. But like, how long does it take for Hashem to see a return on the investment in us? The energy, the life, the strength, the intellect, the finances. How long does it take? And what Rav Shimon Shkop is saying is as long as we realize that we're a steward on certain kochos in order to help others, then we're going to get more. If not, like Nachum Ish Gamzu, he says, that's the end. I wasn't doing it. I defaulted. I wasn't paying back the investment fast enough. And that's what the Chidah says. Kama malos tovas la'makom aleinu. Folks, we didn't deserve nothing. None of this. And if we're going to really do this right, we need to figure out how we're paying back all that investment at us as a nation, as in individuals. That's what's happening. That's the Diana over here. What a humbling thought. What an opportunity to realize if we are good at something, it must mean we're good at that because we need to share it somehow. Well, folks, let's do a quick recap. Kana Bayan Shoel, idea number one, using the night of the Seder to also ask, to dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Number two, why are our matzah decals separate from our challah decals? Why are there three compartments? And the idea of treating ideas differently. Number three, why are the intellectual somehow involved in the Seder as well? Because it's not about intellect, it's about experience, which is through stories. Rabbi Norman Lamb's defense of simplicity, the Ben Atam, the person who lives Judaism experientially more than the person who has all the fancy ideas. The leaning being the way that sometimes through the deserts of life, HaKadosh Baruch Hu with us. And finally, what a lot of investments we've had. How are we going to show it? When are we paying back that investment? Have we deserved what it is that we've been given? I hope it's a meaningful Pesach. I hope it's a beautiful Pesach. Thank you so much for being here. I hope it's a wonderful, wonderful Chag Kashrus Sameach.